We got started really about 10 years ago is when the conversation on ocean acidification began to take off, realizing that Alaska was going to be a hotspot for this issue. And Jeremy Mathis, who was a professor at UAF at the time, started, he was kind of the first researcher on the scene in Alaska, and started giving presentations that were really head turning. I think realizing that this is a big deal, that we don't know much about it, and that Alaska is a natural hotspot for ocean acidification because our water is cold, and cold water absorbs more gas than warm water. And so we already have more carbon dioxide in our system. We are then closer to a threshold level that could cause harm to species. So we first started putting moorings and sensors out in 2011. And there was actually a mooring outside of Kodiak between 2013 and 2016. And the research there has really continued to grow. And I can talk, if there's questions later, I can talk more about kind of how we're doing that monitoring.
So if I were to ask a bit of a question that may sound simple to you, but is a bit complicated to me, can you sort of explain the cause of ocean acidification and why it's bad and what mechanism by which it makes things more dangerous for our local species?
Yeah, absolutely. So ocean acidification is a global process that's driven by additional carbon emissions from human uses going into the atmosphere. So as we drive our cars and we generate electricity and we fly on airplanes and do all the things that is required right now to run our society, if we're using fossil fuels for those things, carbon emissions are going into our atmosphere. So this is causing climate change. But about a third of it gets of that carbon dioxide gets absorbed by the ocean. So this is actually good for the atmosphere. Climate change would be accelerating a lot more rapidly if the ocean wasn't serving as a carbon sink. But as carbon dioxide is absorbed into seawater, a chemical reaction takes place and it makes it more acidic. And I should mention too that our waters here are not actually acidic. You can remember back to probably high school chemistry with the pH scale, where low pH is more acidic, around in lower it's 1 to 14, and 7 is neutral. And ocean water is on average around 8.1, so it's just a little bit basic. But the concern is that as we make the water more acidic, species are used to their natural range of acidity. And so even if the water is not outright acidic, it can be too acidic for creatures to thrive.
And do correct me if I'm wrong, but at a more biological level, there are certain processes, for example, reproduction for certain species that are sort of tuned to behave at a very particular degree of acidity. And as the acidity levels, some of those mechanisms can get sort of screwy. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. It's actually interesting. It's even with humans. Like our blood is a very specific pH level between like 7.35 and 7.45, I believe. And so if it changes like more than a tenth, humans can actually go into a coma or stop breathing. So we all organisms have a pretty tightly regulated system to deal with a certain pH level. And if you look at sea creatures, we often think of shell-building creatures that need where lower acidity water can make it hard for them to form their shells or actually dissolve shells if it's acidic enough. And so creatures like crab or pteropods, which are a tiny type of swimming phytoplankton, looks like a little sea butterfly, that are a primary source of food for pink salmon, those are have been kind of a canary in the coal mine type for ocean acidification. I think partly because you can take very cool and beautiful pictures of their shells, but if you submerge them in more acidic water, you can see those shells slowly start to erode. So ocean acidification can be a problem for shell builders. It can also be a problem for fish with growth or reproduction or behavioral issues. And there's been a lot of work done on trying to understand species response to ocean acidification, right here in Alaska also, and even in Kodiak. The NOAA lab has been very active in multi-year studies with crab. They've studied red king, blue king, golden king, southern tanner, and snow crab. And they've found that results vary between species and at different life stages, but in general, crab survival went down at most life stages, particularly with red king and southern tanner crab. So there's a lot of still a lot of questions out there, realizing that lab studies usually provide kind of worst case impacts or worst case results, I should say, because you know, the species that's there in the lab doesn't have a chance to try to adapt. You know, it couldn't move to a different location. It couldn't try eating something different. It's kind of stuck there in the lab. And so the researchers usually say, okay, this could be worst case scenario, but it does look for a lot of species, as we kind of tease out winners and losers, the general picture for a lot of species is not looking good. There are some species that are at this stage are giving hope that they could be fairly resilient. Walleye pollock is one of those species.
So this is the sort of question where it's totally acceptable for you to say it's just more complicated than that. But one of the things that I can imagine our listeners thinking is, okay, we have ocean acidification. This is affected by global warming. And, you know, we already have effects today. Is there some sort of timetable that you're looking at? Or I know they have the benchmark of, like, you know, we can tolerate 1.5 degrees centigrade increase of heat. And if we hit like 5 degrees centigrade increase of heat, we're going to have just disastrous effects. Is there some sort of like timetable or some sort of degree of like acceptable ocean acidification that you guys understand? And do you have any predictive model for, say, if we continue at the rate we're going 30 years from now, what are the oceans going to be like, and how will local species be impacted?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because ocean acidification is a global problem, but it is playing out differently at the local level depending on regional influences and drivers. I mentioned before, like, the cold water is an exacerbator, freshwater outflow can be an exacerbator. So the conditions in Resurrection Bay are quite different from the conditions up in the Beaufort, which are different than the conditions in Lynn Canal out by Juneau. And so one of the things we're trying to do now on the research side is document these ranges of natural variability, like what the baseline is, and start to tease out the noise in the data, the seasonal and year-to-year variability versus this kind of longer-term signal, stronger signal in the background that is where the acidity is increasing. And so we're still learning, you know, in some places in Alaska, we've learned, oh, it doesn't actually make sense to monitor there because there's so much variability that it's going to take us a long time to figure out the signal. And there's other places we're like, oh, we can really learn a lot more from this specific location. And what we're learning right now is that there is corrosive water in Alaska waters right now in some parts of the state during certain times of year. And it's also really seasonal. And in the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea, the phytoplankton bloom actually plays a big role in just the seasonality of the carbon chemistry data. And this is kind of an interesting process. The carbon, or the when the phytoplankton have their big bloom in the spring, early summer, they are sucking carbon dioxide out of the water column, and so consequently the CO2 goes down a little bit. It becomes a little bit less acidic, but then those phytoplankton die and they fall through the water column down to the bottom. So you're basically kind of pumping, they think of it as a biological pump, where you're pumping carbon dioxide down to the deep water, which eventually will get circulated back up to the top. So if you look at the data across seasons, you can see these kind of continual seasonal fluxes. But then in the background, if we project out to say 2100, there are predictive models that are showing that the amount of time where we're dealing with this corrosive water is continuing to increase. And there's a few hotspots around the state that the research community has started to identify. One is in Lynn Canal up by Juneau, because of that freshwater influence coming out of the Tongass is really big. The outer shelf of the Bering Sea, and we're starting to try to track this annually and provide information as much as possible to, we just started sending information to like the Pacific Fisheries Management Council on an annual basis, as an indicator to start tracking.
So I think this is a good time to transition from sort of the nitty gritty details about ocean acidification to the response towards ocean acidification and the work that you guys do to prevent it. How are you guys sort of plugging in with different groups around the state to achieve the goal of having a as much of a normal ocean as possible?
I would say the engagement side of ocean acidification has been a huge bright spot for Alaska. And I should preface this by reminding, just saying that ocean acidification is such a big and complicated problem, and there's already a lot of momentum in the system, and there's a lot of uncertainty. And I think Alaskans have realized that it's going to take all of us. It's going to take the researchers in documenting change and trying to understand influences on the local level, but it doesn't stop there. It's the reason that most people care is because it infects humans. And some of the most at-risk groups in Alaska have been really engaged from the beginning. And the fishing industry has shown a lot of interest. There's been a lot of outreach to the fishing industry from researchers in the network, and a lot of inquiries from the industry to the research community. And we've been able to set up dialogues in coastal communities. The United Fishermen of Alaska have been really engaged and helped send information out to their constituencies. Interaction at the Pacific Marine Expo in Seattle and through the Salmon Habitat Information Program. So a lot of conversation is going on. There's also been a strong partnership with the crabbing industry. So I think the researchers really feel a responsibility to make sure through our monitoring that we're trying to answer the most relevant questions to people in Alaska, and the fishing community, as well as coastal communities and tribes, have been really key. I should mention there's about 20 communities around the state that are collecting weekly water samples, including 4 locations in Kodiak.
So now you've created this podcast. Why? What was your reasoning for going about making this podcast, and what is the message that you're trying to get out with it?
Yeah, I feel like I've been doing a lot of talking. Mm-hmm. I should pass it over to Dorothy Childers, who is a member of the Ocean Acidification Network's executive committee and was really brought so much energy and vision to this podcast. So Dorothy, I'm going to let you answer that one.
Thank you, Darcy. Yeah, so like Darcy said, there have been a lot of science presentations in coastal communities all around the state for a long time, and a lot of engagement. One of the questions that usually gets asked at one of these events is, what can we do? And the answer is two parts. One is support the research so we can better understand what's happening, and that's really critical. But the other part that comes up more and more is, well, how can we throttle back on this problem? How can we fix it? Can we fix it? And so the steering committee or the a network has a fisheries working group, and we had the similar conversation there. And there was some interest in having the network look at, you know, actual solutions to carbon emissions as the root cause of both ocean acidification and ocean warming. So that sort of sparked the idea of developing this podcast as a tool to deliver information about solutions to carbon emissions. And we looked at carbon policy as, you know, how you would do that. And so the podcast is really supposed to be an exploration into some of those things, and so that people can better understand what they are.
So my background is in radio and podcast production, and I can certainly say that there is a enormous distance between coming up with an idea for a podcast and actually shipping the final product. Can you tell me a little bit about what that journey was like? How did the whole podcast come together?
Well, I think it was kind of natural. You know, we wanted to make sure that we set the table properly with setting up the scientific basis for why we need to be talking about solutions. And so that's why the first two episodes of the podcast are really focused on what is ocean acidification, and the second, what is ocean warming? And then kind of a lead into what are scientists internationally saying about what we need to do in terms of emissions. And so there's a bit about the International Panel on Climate Change, which is the international body that has produced really all of the consensus-based findings about what is happening with climate change globally, and developing the models that show what we're looking at in the future if we continue with emissions as we have today, or if we reduce emissions by X amount, and what the future looks like with those different scenarios. So we wanted to set that table first, and then the rest of the episodes are really economists who we interviewed talking about their views about, what policies or certain policies are, how they work in terms of deriving an economics or a signal through the economy to reduce emissions. And then the last episode focuses on Kodiak, because Kodiak is a star when it comes to renewable energy infrastructure. And so we wanted to, share statewide and other listeners outside of Kodiak what experience you've had and how successful you've been, and really what a remarkable model you are for moving towards an almost 100% renewable energy system or renewable electricity generation, and then how that might lead down the road to electrifying more aspects of Kodiak's energy needs in terms of transportation and heating and whatnot.
So I'll get into some of the content of the podcast proper in a moment here, but lastly, I just wanted to ask, there are so many different ways to tell a story now. Why did you guys decide to go with a podcast?
Oh, well, because people like to listen. And people maybe have a longer attention span for listening than for reading complicated analytical things that economists write about difficult subjects. I thought a conversation would be a lot more friendly and accessible for people who are just learning about these things.
So you mentioned that the first two episodes of the podcast sort of laid the groundwork for what ocean acidification is and what ocean warming is. And then I believe that over the next three episodes, you guys were discussing some of the different ideas of solutions. Can you talk a little bit about what some of those proposed solutions are and how they work?
Yeah, well, we chose to focus on carbon pricing, which is just the economist term for putting a price on emissions. The idea being that right now we don't have a price on emissions, so we pay a relatively low price for fossil fuels, but down the road we're going to pay a big price for our use of fossil fuels, and that's called the social cost of carbon. So carbon pricing is a tool that economists are promoting that puts a price at the beginning so that we can put that signal in the economy, drive down the use of fossil fuels, and thus the emissions that are causing ocean warming and ocean acidification. So we looked at pricing, carbon pricing, as a primary tool, and that's because economists have done a lot of analysis on this, and there's examples of carbon pricing being applied around the world. So that's why we looked at that. And then in the last episode, we talked with people who are doing renewable energy work all around the state, in Kodiak as well, but all around the state. And while those aren't specifically about pricing, we do cover issues about financing, and also just the kinds of tools that communities and households and schools in terms of curriculum and statewide and nationally, how we can advance some of these renewable technologies.
So can you talk a little bit about, like, as far as some of these carbon pricing ideas. What were some of the comments from economists to the effect of the practicality and the likelihood that they would be employed in the near future?
Well, I think the message is that we're going to pay for ocean acidification or ocean warming one way or another. You know, we can pay now with a price on emissions and use that the revenue that's generated from that to support that transition and also to, you know, drive this signal through the economy that is an incentive for different industries, manufacturing, utilities, transportation sector, everybody to, you know, use their own ingenuity to reduce their emissions. We can do it that way, or we can wait and we can do nothing and wait until we're paying the price in the form of disrupted fisheries and, you know, a lot of very painful social costs.
So climate change has been big in the news lately. There have been, you know, recent international summits. Have you guys seen any discussion recently on ocean acidification or ocean warming? And did it inspire confidence in you, the solutions that were being discussed?
Well, I mean, the reason that the international community is meeting this week in Glasgow, Scotland about what we're going to do about climate change. I mean, that, the conversation is very wide throughout the world. And the reason they're talking about it is because of warming and in all the ways that warming is affecting our biosphere. You know, it's affecting the climate, it's affecting the ocean in direct ways that have bearing on our fisheries and other marine life. And ocean acidification is the same. They share the same root cause. So when they're talking about climate change, I think there's an understanding, even though it might not be technically perfectly accurate, but there's a general understanding that we're talking about all the things that carbon emissions, all the results that carbon emissions have in our world. And that's climate change, warming, or climate disruption, and ocean acidification as well.
I might mention too that there is a global ocean acidification network that I think has members of over 80 countries that are tracking ocean acidification and trying to work together on an international stage, both to advance research and also share ideas for adaptation and engagement. And there's the International Ocean Acidification Alliance, which helps work with countries and states and local communities on ocean acidification action plans. And there's a growing number of entities from the national to the local level that are putting together action plans, often by their governments, to address this. So it's definitely like not just an Alaska issue, not a US issue, but the whole world right now is realizing that there's a lot of momentum in the system. Carbon-wise, that even if we stopped emitting right now, it would take about 7 generations to turn this around in the ocean. And so we are going to need to adapt to a new ocean in the future. And the more that we can work together on that, the better off we will be.
So I have a question that I want to leave open-ended to all three of you. We're down to our last 5 minutes here, but I have had some people who I would probably describe as serious climate pessimists on Talk of the Rock before, people who really think that we're in really big trouble. And I certainly know many members of my own generation who think that this is going to get a whole lot worse before it gets any better. And lately also Greta Thunberg has been coming out and saying that she is a pretty serious dissatisfaction with the rate of change and the responsiveness of politicians. So I want to ask the three of you, How do you see this shaking out in the future? Do you think that we're going to come together as a species and avert climate catastrophe, or do you think that we are in serious trouble and this needs to be taken as seriously as possible?
Can I say both? I think that we are facing really serious trouble, but I think there's also reason for a lot of optimism, specifically for this interest and increased amount of engagement, and tools like the ones that Dorothy just described and that the podcast covers that really would allow us to scale up change and reduction in emissions in a much more efficient and effective and more swift way than were we to all, you know, kind of just do our best around our house to make small changes. When presenting, I often leave audiences with a final slide that shows the scenario of the business as usual with carbon emissions, and then the one where we do something fairly rapidly, and those trajectories for ocean pH. And you can really see, you know, in the next 20 years, those lines aren't hugely diverging. But if you look out to 2100, there are major differences between us doing something now and us not doing something now. So it is not too late to put on the brakes. This is actually like the most critical time we've had in history to act. And I think the podcast shows that there are tools already out there and in use. And the more we can refine those tools and increase awareness about them and we get support behind them, the better chance we have.
We're down to our last moment here. What is the podcast called and where can people find it?
It's called Our Future Ocean, and you can find it at www.thefutureoceanpodcast.com, or you can Google the website, or it's also available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. So lots of options.
Darcy Dugan, Dorothy Childers, Maggie Wall, thank you all so very much for coming on. Really appreciate it. This has been another episode of KMXT 100.1 FM's Talk of the Rock.